Welcome to the Golden Age of Baseball with Eddie Robinson, baseball's oldest living player. Eddie was a four-time All-Star first baseman, scout, coach, and front office executive during his amazing 65-year career in baseball. These podcasts will give the baseball enthusiast the opportunity to share a slice of baseball history with someone who actually lived it.
I think we were to the end of my year in Elmira, New York, where we had won the Governor's Cup and gotten $60 bonus for winning it. And I had bought a Hartman trunk with my $60. And that Hartman trunk served me well for years. But I went back to Valdosta, Georgia, and moved back in with Katie Yeomans. My mother and I had lived with Katie Yeomans the winter before, and my mother was now in California. So I moved in with Katie, and she was like a mother to me. I didn't eat there. She didn't cook for me, but I just enjoyed staying with her. And it was very centrally located. It was about one block from Skinny Vincent's drugstore. And Skinny's drugstore was right next door, right across the street from Georgia State Women's College, which was an all-girls school at that time. And there were a lot of girls around. And it was next door to a hospital, Lowndes County Hospital. And I had a good friend in the hospital named Reds Vincent. Now, Reds had the same last name as Skinny. Skinny owned the drugstore. Reds was one of the chief nurses at the hospital. And she became a good friend of mine, not a girlfriend, just a girl I'd sit and have coffee with or a soda with in the drugstore. She had a brand new Buick car. Occasionally, she would loan me her Buick to take my girlfriend out on a date. And that was very popular with me and my girlfriend. And I got to tell you that that was the first directional indicator I ever saw, that Buick. As I was saying, the car had a directional indicator in it. And that was something very novel and new. Anyway, I spent one winter there in Valdosta and dated the same girl and all winter. J.F. Holmes, the owner of the Coca-Cola Company, and I were good friends. It was a very good arrangement I had. I didn't miss Parrish, Texas at all. I just didn't have all that many good memories of Parrish. Having worked hard all the way through high school, I didn't like to think about it. So came time to go to spring training in 1942. And I was going, of course, I was owned by the Baltimore Orioles. And I was going to spring training with them this year in Hollywood, Florida. The year before, we'd gone to Haines City, which was in the center of the state. This year was Hollywood, which was on the coast. And we were staying in a motel which was not on the coast, but it wasn't but a couple of blocks off the coast. Very nice place. We got meal money and we ate out. We didn't have to eat in the hotel like we did in Haines City. A lot of our team was comprised of players that Cleveland had sent there for the year, to play for the year, for more seasoning. My roommate was Bob Lemon. And Bob and I had played against each other the year before. Remember, he was the third baseman at Wilkes-Barre, the team we beat in the playoffs. And he was a good third baseman. He had a great arm. He was from Long Beach, California. His dad owned a filling station there. And I think it was a gathering point for all the young ball players in and around Long Beach. But Bob was a great guy, and we had a lot of fun rooming together in the spring. And he was a pretty darn good hitter with power. And we had Jack Conway, a Cleveland player. He played shortstop for us. Ted Sepkowski was our second baseman, and I played first. And we didn't have any we did. Hank Edwards, a Cleveland product, he was playing right field for us. Our catcher was not a major leaguer. So we had a pretty good team. We didn't have any pitchers from the Indians at the time. They had sent most of the players. We were ready to play the 1942 season. And we got off to a pretty good start. And before the season started, we were back in Baltimore like the year before. And Cleveland called up Tommy Thomas, the manager, and said he wanted to send a first baseman who had led the Eastern League in hitting the year before. They wanted to option him to Baltimore. And Tommy refused. He said, I like Robinson, and he's going to be my first baseman. And he came to me after that conversation and told me that Dad wanted to send the first baseman there who had played for Wilkes-Barre. Larry Barton was his name, and he had led the league in hitting. Tommy Thomas wouldn't listen to it. So I was the first baseman, and I rewarded him with a pretty good year. I think I hit 27 home runs, and I drove in over 100 runs. And we were in the playoffs, but we didn't go very far. But I enjoyed playing in Baltimore. And during the season, we were about to go into war. We were in the war in the Pacific and getting in it in Europe. So we knew there was a good likelihood that we would have to be in the service. Not that we wanted to, but we thought that we would have to be. And, of course, we wanted to serve our country. And if other players were going and other people leaving their jobs and going into the service, we felt that we were obligated to do that too. Bob Feller set the example for all baseball players. He was one of the first to enlist. He enlisted in the Navy. He set the example for everybody. So I played that year knowing that at the end I would have to go in. I was in the beginning. I was classified 3A because I was supporting my mother. And if you were supporting a parent, you had a classification of 3A, and you were not eligible for the draft. But at the end of the season, right after the season was over, they took away that 3A classification. And I was either going to be drafted or I could enlist. And, of course, I wanted to enlist. During the year, Tommy Thomas, our manager, had a good friend whose name was Alfred Gwynn Vanderbilt. And Alfred Gwynn was of the famous Vanderbilt family, the railroad tycoons. He was a great baseball player. He used to come to the games, and before the game, he'd come down during batting practice, and he'd sit on the bench with us, all of us players, and we got to know him on a first-name basis. And he told all of us, he said, if you want to go in the Navy, he said, I'm in the Navy. He was a lieutenant, and he was in the enlistment office in Washington. He said, I'll be glad to help you get into the Navy, and any of you that want to, come over. Well, I remembered that. And the Vanderbilt family, the reason he was in Baltimore was the fact that their family owned in Green Spring Valley. Now, Green Spring Valley was a beautiful big valley outside Baltimore, probably 15 miles outside the city. It was comprised, made up of horse farm. And the Vanderbilts had a horse farm out there in the valley, and they raised thoroughbreds. And one of their thoroughbreds became very famous. Alfred Grinn was a great guy and very famous. I mean, he's one of the most famous horse racing personalities. He's had so many famous racehorses. I guess one of the most famous was called Native Dancer. I know one spring, several years later, I was in spring trail with Philadelphia, and we were in Palm Beach, Florida, in spring training. And Alfred came out to see us and see me. And we were talking. I said, "Looks like you got a pretty good horse." He said, "I think I have a good horse. Native Dancer is going to win a lot of money." And Native Dancer did that for him. He told me, he said, "Eddie, when you get reclassified and you're 1A and you're ready to enlist," he said, "why don't you give me a call? I'm over in Washington." And he said, "Gene Tooney, the former heavyweight boxing champion of the world," he said, "Gene's a good friend of mine, and he has a program in the Navy called the Tooney Program. And in the Tooney Program, they take college athletes, at least 2 years of college, and they prepare them to set up recreational activities for the troops. For instance, in all the islands that Japan had taken from us and had owned, when we would take those islands back and we would put troops on them, they would need some recreation. And the guys that were trained in the Tooney program would be sent in there to set up those programs. So they were really did valuable jobs. He said, "I'll take you to see Tooney. And I know you don't quite have 2 years of college, but," he said, "maybe Tooney will make an exception for us and put you in. And if he does, you'll go in the Navy as a chief athletic specialist." Now, chief in the Navy is a good rate. If you're a chief, they don't salute you, but you have you have much respect in the Navy if you're a chief. Most chiefs have to be in the Navy 12 years before they become chiefs. And you get a hash mark for every 4 years. Or every 3 years you get a hash mark. And we were chiefs, but we didn't have any hash marks. And they jokingly called us slick arm chiefs because we were chiefs without any hash marks. But anyway, I did that. He said, "Get all your clippings together, your newspaper clippings, and proof that you were a good football player in high school and baseball player, and bring them with you, and we'll go see Tooney." So I did that. I got all my clippings together. And I called Alfred up. I said, "I'm ready to go." He said, "Okay, come on over." And we set a time for the following week, and I met him. And we went to one of those big buildings in Washington. That's where Tooney had his office. And Gene Tooney, I was really proud and pleased to meet him. He was such a big man in the sports world. He had been heavyweight champion for a long time. He was a full lieutenant in the Navy and the head of this Tooney program. So Alfred introduced me to him. We sat and talked for quite a long time. He didn't even bother to look at my newspaper clippings or anything. He said, "Well, Alfred's say-so, I'm thinking that you certainly qualified for this program." And he said, "I'm going to put you in it." He said, "You have an option of when you want to go in. Do you want to go in October or do you want to go in December?" And he said, "You'll go in as a chief and you'll go into training in Norfolk, Virginia." That was all very good news to me. And I said, of course, that I would prefer to go into the Navy in December. He said, "Fine," and we shook hands and left. I said goodbye to Alfred. The next time I saw him was when he came to visit me in Palm Beach, Florida. But that's how I got in the Navy. And I went ahead and lived in Baltimore in the winter of 1942 up until December the 15th. I was to go into the Navy on December the 15th, which was my birthday. That was going to be my 22nd birthday. I did. I got on the train and went to Norfolk and got off the train and took a taxi to the Norfolk Naval Training Station. The Norfolk Naval Training Station is a huge place. And they, at the time, were training destroyer escort sailors. And destroyer escorts were, they were ships almost as big as a destroyer. They looked like a destroyer. And they did practically the same work as a destroyer. They escorted fleets of ships across the ocean. They escorted them, kept the submarines from sinking them. It was a very important job and a very important ship. And all of their crew members were trained in Norfolk, Virginia. But also in Norfolk, Virginia was a naval air station. All the Navy, big Navy planes were there. And that was a huge base, too. And they were adjoining. They were right next door. It'd take you a long time to ride from one side to the other. But I reported to, it was night. It was like 10 o'clock at night when I reported, when I got to Norfolk Naval Training Station. And they took me to a barracks, a two-story barracks, and they took me in, took me to a bunk, double bunk, upper and lower bunk. And I had the upper bed. And they gave me a blanket, and there was a pillow on the bed, no sheets, just a blanket. And they said, "That's where you sleep tonight, and tomorrow you get the rest of your stuff." So I climbed up in the upper bunk, which wasn't any easy deal. I'd never done it before, but I didn't step on the guy below me, and turned out we became good friends. But I got up there, spent my birthday night in the upper bunk in the Navy, and the next day I became a full-fledged Chief Petty Officer in the U.S. Navy.
Thank you for listening to The Golden Age of Baseball with baseball legend Eddie Robinson. If you have questions for Eddie or would like to suggest a topic for him to discuss, please email eddie.robinson65@yahoo.com. This is Greg Ricks inviting you to check out Eddie's other podcasts. And for an even deeper dive into the Golden Age of Baseball, read his autobiography, Lucky Me, My 65 Years in Baseball, which you can find on goodreads.com and on Amazon.